thinning? Is that what you're saying? Over to you again, Alan.
Right, it would be the spin of the each electron making up the orbitals in the atom that give it magnetic properties. And well, by applying an external magnetic field, you can align all these spins in the same direction of what nuclear magnetic resonance is used for. By applying an external magnetic field, that's how they get results for NMR. So I do believe it's the spin.
And I found the confirmation of this is structure of the spins of ice can come from unexpected places where physicists describe magnets on microscopic scale. They consider contribution of the various parts of the system. When such a fractured magnet, a port is actually created by the spin.
Okay, C2QIQ.
Let me go back to Alan. Alan, you use the word spin in an ambiguous manner. Are you talking about the spin of an individual electron around its mass center, or are you talking about the spin of the electron around the nucleus and the axis of that, let me call it orbital spin? Is it orbital spin, or is it rotational spin? Which kind of spin are you talking about as the major cause of magnetic field that you glean from reading Griffiths? KC2OLB, K2RIW?
KC2OLB. It is the spin. Alright, so the bosons are the electrons. Okay, so it's the spin, the net angular momentum of the electron.
So you're talking about even if the electron was not in an orbit around the nucleus, if it was just sitting still, so to speak, at a fixed distance from the nucleus, in my crazy model, but now it spins about itself, just the way the Earth rotates, are we talking about electron rotation, or are we talking about electron orbital spin? Which one of the spins do you think is the major cause of the magnetic field? Over to you, Alan.
From what I've read, I would say it would be the electron rotation.
Okay, understand. We're going to come back to this a little bit later on. Do you have any of the mailbag things that we should be covering tonight, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I have two quick ones. I'll save the talk on meters for next week. No problem. Let me let it drop. Okay, got a quick one on tube testers. I have a gentleman who wants to know, in fact, there's two of them that wrote to me this week, the difference between mutual conductance testers, transconductor testers, or conductance testers. What does that all mean, and what is the difference?
Yeah, I guarantee there's two, three, four different kinds of tube testers that we used back in the days when thermionic emission devices, vacuum tubes, were very popular. Some of the very simple tube testers applied filament voltage, heated up the cathode, put a fixed bias on the control grid as a function of the way you set the knobs. If you're testing a 6SN7 or a 12AT7, they told you to set these knobs a particular way. And those knobs would apply a particular voltage to the plate, a particular negative voltage to the grid, and measure plate current. That's a simple emission tester. And you can get a good bad reading out of that. The more elaborate tube testers really put not only a DC bias on the control grid, but a real AC signal. Put a real signal, and maybe it's a 1KC note, but a real AC signal was applied to the control grid, and the other grids, the screen grid and suppressor grid, they were all given their right voltage when you set the knobs correctly. And then the tube tester looked at the magnitude of the AC signal appearing on the plate when you set the knobs correct way, a particular plate resistance existed between the plate and the power supply, the D-plus supply. So It really measured AC voltage in versus AC voltage out, and really measured, let me call it, voltage gain under a particular condition. Now you're measuring dynamic transconductance. So the more elaborate tube testers did that. But I think that was more rare. I think many of the tube testers just gave you fixed voltages on the grid and looked for the proper amount of plate voltage. And some of them also had more than one mode of testing, where you flip some switches where maybe a great big bias was put on the grid. And
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Maybe a great big negative bias was put on the control grid, and the tube was expected to go into a very low plate conversion, plate current condition, and if it didn't, then it would tell you that there was excess gas in the tube. But I think the dynamic tester would be the best way to find out if the tube was gassy, because in many cases, a gassy tube is going to give you less AC gain. These are my opinions. I mean, I own a Heathkit tube tester that I built from the kit form. I've been to a whole lot of drugstores that had tube testers. I've been in a couple of testing laboratories that have tube testers. And they had a roll chart where you would roll the chart until you found your particular tube, and it told you how to set all of these knobs, filament voltage, control grid voltage, and everything else. The knobs weren't necessarily named that way, but that's my recollection of tube testers. Now, some of you guys out there have got more experience with them than I do, and so tell me what your experience with tube testers are. What were they really doing when they were measuring transconductance? By the way, transconductance really means change in voltage on the input terminal versus change of current on the output terminal. That's what I believe transconductance means. Anybody with any further opinions as to what tube testers really did, the good ones and the cheap ones, give me a call, letters and name right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. We have nobody out there with experience in tube testers. One more call. Doesn't anybody have experience with tube testers and know what really was being tested? Okay. Did I hear somebody's name? But transconductance, delta voltage in, delta current out. In other words, current output could be called conductance. It's caused by a voltage in. There are kinds of, you can buy operational amplifiers which will convert current input into voltage output. You can buy operational amplifiers that will change voltage input into voltage output. And are there transconductance? Yes, I think there are. You can buy kinds of operational amplifiers that act somewhat like a vacuum tube. Change of voltage in changes the current output, not necessarily the voltage out. So you can buy various kinds of operational amplifiers, and if you hook them up the right way with two or more of them with feedback, you can make negative impedance converters, you can make gyrators. Oh boy, you can do all kinds of funny things these days. All right, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I tried hitting you with echo lecture, if you didn't hear me. There's a number of different kinds of tube testers. The ones that I had actually merely were good at low frequencies. They would they would actually do delta voltage in versus voltage out. They'd measure gain. They would also, the good ones, would measure transconductance between, if you had a tube that was a multiple grid, it would actually calculate the capacitance between the control grid and the screen grid, between the screen grid and the plate. What else did it do? This was a really high-end tube tester. The ones that you saw in the drugstore, they basically look for gain. You put a particular voltage on the grid, you look for the change in the plate, and that was it. Some of them actually looked at emission between the cathode and the plate. They were very simple. And some of them just basically lit up the filament, put a little voltage on the plate, and looked for a current that was going there. And if based upon the bias that was put on the grid, the meter would read in the good zone. If you didn't have good emission, it would read in the red zone.
So the red zone, green zone, and some of those were simply an emission tester. In other words, if the amount of emission of a cathode was lower than it should be because the filament wasn't working right, or the cathode was contaminated, or there was gas in the tube, a fixed voltage on the control grid on a good tube should produce a particular current on the plate, and any less than that current showed a decrease of emission, which usually would also be a decrease in gain of the tube, but gain might not be actually being measured in that inexpensive drugstore tube tester. Is that somewhat true, Eric? KE2EJ, shout into your mic a little bit. K2LAW.
No, that's exactly it. I've zipped quite many a drugstore tube tester, and some of them were so fixed that they actually had the tube number printed by the socket. You know, it would be a list of like five or six tubes. You know, the tubes would be similar in terms of its gain, its transconductance. The really good, expensive, fancy tube testers. Actually, I had one that actually would put 100 kilohertz on the grid and see if it would actually take a half a volt of AC signal on the grid, and then based on the plate voltage of the tube, it would calculate and figure out that you should have X amount of voltage gain. And if you got that voltage gain, you got a good tube.
Yeah, some of the really fancy tubes that were used as a combination oscillator mixer, pentagrid converters, I guess it is possible to apply an AC voltage to each one of the grids one at a time and measure whether or not you're getting the right amount of transconductance to that plate. Because if there's a slim possibility that one of those grids have been damaged, in the case of a tetrode tube, which happens not to be a popular one that'll plug into a tube tester. A 4CX250B tube, I think very few tube testers can test that one. But where you've got a real control grid and a screen grid, and depending on what you may have done to abuse that tube, you may have burned up some of those wires on the screen grid, in which case measuring transconductance between screen and plate, or putting a fixed voltage on the screen and measuring the control grid gain to the tube could give you indication of screen grid damage, gas, low emission, decrease of life, and so on. So lots and lots of ways you can test a tube. How many of the tube testers really did all of that? Only the very expensive ones, I think, did. And so I'll bet you some of the industrial grade ones that were used in a tube factory must have been something else. Back to you for any further comments on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
I guess the best tube testers I remember is I had a friend who used to work at Amprex when they were in Hicksville. And they made power tubes. And what they would do for each line of tube, they actually built a quote-unquote amplifier. That's where, actually, when we were at, when we had NASTAR back in the late 60s, we had a number of the test amplifiers, and it was a glass tube that would run at 2 meters and 440. I'm trying to remember. It was like a 4-500 or something like that. It was one of their tubes that made it up to 300 megahertz, and another one that made it up to like 500 or 600 megahertz. Where they built these amplifiers with all sorts of interesting controls on them to control the emission from the cathode, to change the value on the control grid. Some of them were grounded grid tubes, so you actually put the signal on the cathode, measured with the high voltage. Some of the high voltages, I think, on the tube. The one that we used to make kilowatt on 2 meters with one of them, and I actually hooked Jesse. Decided to put fluorescent bulbs around the antenna and, you know, light the whole runway up when the runways were still there. But they actually custom manufactured their own test jig for each one of their tubes, which was quite interesting.
Among really serious hi-fi enthusiasts, where you would use a really fancy tube-type amplifier, push-pull amplifier, you'd feel compelled to buy tubes in matched pairs, push-pull tubes in matched pairs. And so 5880 and some of those tubes like that.
5888 for the audio file.
Okay, so when you had a matched pair, I'm guessing you were matching it on emission, in other words, a fixed amount of control grid voltage and a certain amount of plate current, and also matching them on real transconductance, voltage into the grid versus current swing out of the plate. So to really get a matched pair, what do you think was the major parameter being matched when you paid the premium to buy a matched pair, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW?
What you were really paying for was the precision of the two little wires that held the grid. So the distance between the grid, the screen grid and the suppressor, and the distance between the cathode and the plate. And they went through, I remember, they manufactured those tubes, and they would reject more of them and, you know, make separate piles of them. This one had a mu of this value, and this one had a mu of that value. And they wind up with these huge bins of various different concurrent conductance values of each tube, and that's how they would match them up.
So in theory, I could get a matched pair that are low in mu and a matched pair that are high in mu, and they would be a match, but I might not get the same performance out of that amplifier from those two different pairs that I just described. What do you think, Eric?
I agree. In those days, they used to sell tubes by grade. You know, you could get a matched pair of a low mu grade and a matched pair of a high mu grade. And in those days, trying to get between 20 hertz and 15 kilohertz to get it to come out flat, because don't forget, in those days, everybody had to use a plate transformer.
And if I got a really well-matched set of tubes in my push-pull Marantz amplifier, does that mean the third-order intermodulation distortion coming out of that amplifier, when I play the 1812 overture through it at full blast voltage, the full blast power output, and I want to shake the room, am I going to get less third-order intermodulation distortion if I buy the right set of tubes for that amplifier? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Well, you know, IM products were not only a process of the tube itself, there was also a component of the grid transformer and the plate transformer. So, you know, people like Marantz and McIntosh went through a lot of effort to make their transformers so that they matched, and they also would sweep them to see if they could get the same kind of frequency response out of them.
And I think some of those really well-made transformers had voltage taps on the primary winding where the outer two leads of the primary winding went to the plates of the tube and some of the inner windings went to the screen grid, so that, in other words, as the tube was producing that audio, the plate voltage and the screen voltage were swinging with certain ratios in order to give higher linearity. Is that approximately true, Eric?
David Hafler designed that with Dynaco, Dick.
Okay, so Dynaco did that. See what Eric's got to say about that one. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
In the old ones, they did that. They, you know, in the cheap amplifiers, they actually just used a simple voltage divider between the plate and the screen and the suppressor. Sort of like a dyno, you want to think of it like that, or, you know, like a photomultiplier. So you can get more acceleration to the plate. But the really good ones had multiple taps, and at the factory, they would choose which one was the best and which one gave you the best IM.
Hey, go ahead, Glenn. Tell us a little bit about the Dyna Grid Amplifier, I think it was called. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. That was actually a Dynaco thing, and the engineer at the time was called, the man was called David Hafler, who eventually broke off into his own company and made his own amplifiers, the Hafler Amplifier Company. But what's interesting there is that, yes, he was the one who pioneered that that extra winding back to the grid that would allow the a controlled gain, so that the feedback on that audio transformer was always balanced, and this way you could have a variation in the tube and still wind up with the same gain function. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Now, I'm going to ask a quick question to both Glenn and Eric in that order. and that is, among the real serious audiophiles, audio hi-fi experts, there's a significant number of them who say you can't beat the nice, soft, round sound of a tube, a well-designed tube amplifier, that these solid-state amplifiers can't come close. I think with the right kind of feedback mechanism, I think you can get all the fidelity you want out of modern-day op-amp solid-state amplifiers. But not everyone's going to agree with that. Do you have an opinion as to what really makes the nicest sound, tube or solid-state? KE2EJ, no, KC2QIQ first, K2ROW, go ahead, Glenn.
Well, keep in mind, Dick, when it comes to audio, everything's opinion. How much of audio is really scientific anymore at this point, or at least going back to the 60s? I personally think that the sound room that you're listening in, the comfortable chair, the dynamics of the room probably has much more to do with the audio and the speakers than the amplifier. But that's, here again, opinion. But when it comes to tubes versus transistors and power MOSFETs, I think in an audio reproduction system, in my opinion, the power MOSFET probably has an advantage over the tube. But here's the exception. When it comes to playing an electric guitar, on the other hand, when I want to amplify an electric guitar into a guitar amplifier, I want a tube for certain sound dynamics, because a guitar needs a certain amount of distortion, an electric guitar, in order to get the correct kind of tone out of the strings. So by actually overdriving the first audio stage of a tube amplifier has a very, very soft type of a distortion that makes a very, very pleasant guitar note. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think you're getting into that so-called heavy metal sound where you intentionally make a certain kind of distortion because a certain kind of music or certain people like that. Let's see how it...
Can I add a comment to that one, Dick? It's not just heavy metal.
Go ahead, Glenn.
For most guitarists who played an electric guitar, going back to the first person who probably amplified guitars, which was Les Paul, the tube preamps on the front end of the... If you were just to take an electric guitar and plug it into a regular clean-sounding amplifier and you start tuning the strings, you'll notice that if the sound is too pure to the strings, it just doesn't have a very musical tone to it. But when you start overdriving the first stage of the amplifier, it sweetens the string, so it actually has a much more mellow note to it. So even playing jazz, kinds of classical music, anything you want with a guitar, you need that certain amount of overdrive with a tube amplifier to get a really good sound out of an electric guitar. So it's not just heavy metal. It's not that heavy distortion. It's actually part of like tuning a guitar. You need a little bit of overdrive on the first stage in order to get the correct sound out of your electric guitar. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Wild. Eric, KE2EJ, among the audiophiles that have to produce really clean audio for your broadcast, do some of those people prefer tube over solid state? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, there's a whole lot of errors to what's going on there. First of all, there's a lot of different parameters you have to take into consideration. When we talk about old tube amplifiers and the pickups and Peter Goldmark 33 RPM LPs and speakers of the day, versus today, with the solid-state amplifier, what you put in is what you get out, okay? The tube amplifier, and I'll go with Glenn in terms of what he's saying about guitar amplifiers, but today we actually have DSPs, which kind of duplicate what the first preamp, you know, 6AX7. The traditional 6AX7 being overdriven is the front end of an Ampeg or any number of guitar amplifiers. But that's a whole other game. Actually, a friend of mine and I, we had designed and got patented a couple of pickups, including some piezos, because we used to make bass guitars. But anyway, a lot of this is very subjective. And also, a lot of it is a learned response from what it is that you like.
And shout into your mic a little bit, Eric. Go ahead.
Is this good audio for you?
Fantastic.
All right. When Kennedy Drive, and a true binary A to D. None of this PCM crap. And the whole idea was to take a Neumann, you know, a nice microphone, which is as neutral as you can possibly get when you actually create a pink noise source and you put it in the room at a specified distance from the microphone, you get a flat response out of it from the room. And the idea is that you would digitize that and try and reproduce that in the end. Of course, the speaker is flavored, you know, your microphone is flavored in normal recording. So, but when you're doing your New York Philharmonic, you want to try and capture what the room is hearing. And doing that, the digital world is absolutely perfect at that. Okay? Using a tube amplifier, and in the days of the tube amplifiers, the big thing that gave you this, not this distortion, was not only what the tube would do, because you can bias a tube very well so that if you have a certain minimum voltage to a certain maximum voltage, and you operate within it, it was pretty damn linear. But all the flavors would actually come from the iron and the windings of the transformer. That's where it stood out. Listening to vinyl through a tube amplifier is like the best thing you ever heard. Today, of course, we can model and duplicate those characteristics and actually change them with the type of DSP that we do today. If you sample, say, 96 kilohertz rather than 48 kilohertz, you have the opportunity to do a lot of stuff. In broadcasting, we do that. When we had analog audio in our broadcast world,
Timeout. The last minute of what you said did get timed out, Eric. So if you want to repeat the last minute, which is some good material, please do that. Audio is great. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
All right, where'd you lose me?
You had just told us about the flavor of the iron and what it does, and that DSP can duplicate some of that. I know that also some of the solid-state amplifiers can have ridiculously high feedback ratios, which really means damping factor, where the loudspeaker itself thinks it's being fed by a short circuit, and therefore any tendency for the loudspeaker system to have resonances can really be nulled out, so to speak. You didn't mention that, but pretty much after the flavor of the transformer and the DSP, we started that. We didn't hear what you said beyond that, Eric. Go ahead.
All right, well, did you hear the part about broadcast, or is that what you lost?
We heard the beginning of broadcast.
Okay, when we were, you know, as we were to, like, at WNET, we did live from Lincoln Center, the name of the game was to try and capture what was in the Philharmonic Hall and get that over the air. We were at a disadvantage is that regular FM radio, that's why we would simulcast, had 75 kilohertz worth of deviation, whereas the TV had 25. So we had limitations in terms of bandwidth, how the pre-emphasis and the de-emphasis and the time constant would go. The time constant in the FM radio was a little bit better. The noise flow was a little bit better in stereo. Although later on in television, when we went to BPSC, we used something called DVX, which helped to compand and decompand in a better way. But as the broadcasters made their transition from tubes to solid state, the quality of the audio began to get better, because the name of the game in that kind of thing is to try and reproduce what a human being hears in that audience. And as the solid-state electronics, as the ICs, as the op-amps got better and better, the quality, the music got better. In the end, also the change in receiver technology, and as that improved. So, in that sense, the solid-state stuff made a world of difference. K2RO, and of course, it's all subjective. It's all in the eye of, or in the ear of the listener. K2RIW, K2J.
Thank you, Eric. Sounds to me like you've lived through an awful lot of experience with the audio. And in the case of simulcast, to try to make the audio coming out of the loudspeaker of the television set, which maybe in some cases was the right channel, and the audio coming out of the FM tuner was the left channel, if the guy wasn't using stereo tuner, to try to make...
We did that. It was always stereo.
Okay, so, in other words, what does the word simulcast then mean? Okay, I'm beginning to catch on. In the case of simulcast, the view was coming from the television set, but hopefully the audio was coming from the stereo FM tuner. Is that true?
I would do is I would take live feed from Lincolnshire. It would actually come down a radio line, which was good from about 20 hertz to about 25 kilohertz, actually. The noise was down there at like minus 110 or something like that, way, way down there. I would then take that, which of course we would record that to videotape. I would take that at the same time and feed that to WQXR. And WQXR would feed that directly into their transmitter with no companding. They would get rid of all the companders and all the expressors. That would go straight into the transmitter, and then you, the home listener, would tune on your beautiful Marantz or Macintosh stereo with your great Dynaco or whatever FM tuner, and you would turn the sound down on your TV and listen through your FM receiver. And if I did everything right, it would be in perfect sync, and there would be no delays, and it would be a great experience.
Eric, you personally were responsible for how many of those simulcast transmissions? Over to you, Eric.
Oh, I don't know. One heck of a lot of them. I never actually did take count. We also had the live from Vienna New Year's that we used to do. Actually, they still do it. I don't do it anymore. And we don't do it the same way anymore either. But let's see. We had Walter Cronkite doing the bus trip for us.
Fantastic. Hey, John, I know we've got very far left of center of tube testers, but the whole reason that somebody buys tubes these days is quite often for hi-fi audio amplifiers. Very few of us are maintaining old-fashioned television sets with 6SN7 tubes, although there could be some exceptions. Back to you, John, and go on to your next one, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, you and Eric hit it right on the head. I have a large Hickok transconductance tester, and the thing you missed was the match tubes. Well, before we had curve tracers, that was used to match tubes, and you did it on graph paper. That's sort of like how we did the Smith charts, and it took forever, and you paid for it, and really had a search to find tubes, even from good manufacturers, that matched exactly. So that's the story with tube testers. I think we should drop it and send it over to Paul, Dick. What do you think?
Let's see if Paul's available. WS2N, I hope you're there. Tell us what Curiosity's been doing. WS2N, K2RIW. Yeah, I was a little bit afraid of that. Paul didn't sign in. One of the things that I was going to mention is that I've heard two different reports. Paul told us that the laser that's on Curiosity runs at 45 watts, to which I said that's 9,000 times higher than the laser pointer you can legally buy at 5 milliwatts. I've read another report this week that the laser output gave a blast of only a few microseconds and a number of pulses, I think something like 30 consecutive pulses, but each pulse had an effective radiated power of 1 million watts. Now, are they talking about million watts per square meter, or really 1 million watts? I'm not sure. But what they did do is that they measured the spectrum of the puff of material boiled off from that rock on each individual pulse of 30 consecutive pulses of a few microseconds each. And so, therefore, by looking at those various spectrums, let me drop... You could tell the difference between surface dust on the rock versus really vaporizing some of the rock. And they did see a variation in the spectrum of the light coming off, and they're looking at infrared, visual, and ultraviolet. And by looking at all the individual spectral lines, you can tell the difference between what elements are present in that particular rock or surface dust that's on the rock. So some pretty fancy testing is going on, and they've moved it. They've done some motion. They turned on quite a few pieces of equipment. The only failure that occurred was that during the landing sequence, although the sky crane that lowered this 2,000-pound thing called Curiosity to the surface, even though those rockets were 20 meters or 20 feet, I'm not sure which, above on this great big long cord, and they were blasting off to the side, still it kicked up enough pebbles and dust that you can tell by some of the early photographs. They did show you the deck of the Curiosity had pebbles sitting on it that had been kicked up by the landing sequence. And on the main control arm that can be raised that has the cameras and lasers and whatever on the top, there's two different rods coming off to the side, one at the 3 o'clock position and one at the 6 o'clock position, so to speak. And one of those rods, they're both weather rods, which can measure temperature, humidity, and wind speed. And those are rather delicate printed circuit boards buried inside of that rod. One of those rods hung over the side in the way the thing was stacked on the landing sequence. And so a guess was that some of the dust being kicked up impacted one of those delicate printed circuit boards. So those two different weather sensing rods, one of them did get damaged. It's not a showstopper. It just means you can't make wind speed velocities of X and Y simultaneously. You now have to do X and then rotate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
In order to really measure the wind direction as well as velocity, you have to do some rotation of that arm. So one of the many sensors on board did get damaged. But of all the ones that could have been damaged, if you had to choose one, that's probably the best one because it already has a backup, so to speak. Alrighty, that's my little bit of what I've gleaned so far this week on Curiosity. 2,000 watts of heat comes out of the plutonium dioxide pellets, which by their natural radiation are giving off 2,000 watts of heat. That heat, in turn, is being circulated by fluids throughout a very elaborate set of pipes that go throughout all of the instruments that have to be kept warm. And it also goes to the heat sink, which has got these thermocouples in between, and the thermocouples convert that temperature difference into something in the vicinity of 115 watts of electrical power, which continuously charges the lithium batteries on board, and that's what really runs the show. Okay,
Dick, did you want to mention anything about Neil Armstrong?
Yeah, Neil Armstrong passed away. Was it just yesterday, I guess it was. And so that's been on the news a lot. What would you like to say about Neil Armstrong, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
I had nothing in particular prepared, Dick, but I just figured it was such a momentous part of space history for the United States. And to have, you know, the first man to step on the moon, pass away, I thought it was a big event, and didn't really see a whole heck of a lot on television or much in the newspaper, just a couple of little tidbits here and there about it, and I thought that was kind of a shame, considering his accomplishments for the United States.
Yeah, Neil Armstrong took his first airplane flight when he was 6 years of age. When he was 16 years of age, he got his pilot's license before he got his automobile driver's license. He was an aeronautical person from an early age. Did a lot of test piloting. Flew something like 79 missions in Korea and survived it. Survived a number of near accidents when he was practicing with the practice network they had for practicing landing on the lunar rover. They had a failure on it that he had to use the escape mechanism, and he could have gotten heavily injured or killed on that one. Also, I think he was on one of the early Gemini missions, which had a failure. He did, when he stepped onto the moon, he finally, near the end of his life, admitted that the word A was missing. The original intent was to say one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. He finally admitted at the end that, yes, the A was missing. One small step for man. Well, the difference between and mankind is, in theory, nothing. A man versus mankind is what the original statement was supposed to be. Neil Armstrong was chairman of the board of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, which I worked for 35 years. Let me drop. So I did see him face to face on a couple of occasions. And a fairly humble guy, as you can tell. Really didn't go for a whole lot of fanfare on what he did. From his point of view, he was doing his job. And yes, he did say it was an exciting place to be on the moon, and an extremely unusual experience. And he was very disappointed that we gave up lunar landing so soon. We only did a total of, about 5 of them. I think 10 human beings have been to the moon, and we haven't followed up with that. So he's disappointed by that. And with any further questions or comments on the subject of Neil Armstrong, give me a call at us right now. K2RIW in the TechNest.
W2MIT.
W2MIT. By the way, Neil Armstrong died at age 82 as a result of complications of a coronary operation. He had some kind of a coronary operation. I'm guessing it could have been a bypass operation. And as a complication of it, he passed away. W2MIT, go right ahead. K2RIW. Start off with your name, sir.
Hi, this is Gary in Oceanside, W2MIT. And I don't know if this was brought up. I just was tuning in and out while trying to get stuff done at home here. But just wondered on the subject of Neil Armstrong. I have this friend who insists that when you use the term unusual experience, it refers to him making statements about his seeing some type of extraterrestrial, or some type of a base station on the other side of the moon, the side that's hidden from the Earth. Have you heard any of those kind of stories either attributed to him or backed up, something like that? Go ahead.
I haven't heard one specifically associated with Neil Armstrong. However, a number of astronauts have seen things during their missions which are difficult to understand, difficult to explain. And so you could, if you want to, read into it that they were being tracked, that they had some mild encounters with something not of this Earth. You could read that into it. A number of the astronauts did see things. I know that NASA seemed to be trying very hard not to emphasize that for fear that it would be misinterpreted. So I think they were afraid to admit that, and I think they suppressed that kind of information. There have been a couple of reports of where, for instance, two of the astronauts, I forget which mission it was, and maybe it was the Apollo 11, where the astronauts called down to Houston, where was the S-4B booster? In other words, the booster that got disconnected after its use. Everybody knew exactly where it would be. It would be a long distance away. The astronauts were asking Houston where it was because they're seeing it. Those were code words for the fact that they were seeing something very difficult to explain because they knew that it would not be within visual range. So did they really find a moon base on the backside? I'm kind of doubtful. But I think they have seen things during the translunar portion of the path, whether it's from Earth to Moon or Moon back to Earth. They have seen things that are difficult to explain. It's about the best way I can explain it, Gary. W2MIT, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. I did look into one such claim where they did see something outside the command module, and it did turn up to be a piece of the booster that had broken off. So that was explained. but you're right, there seems to be a lot of unexplained phenomena. And I did find at least one website that went so far as to say, you know, the whole 1969 landing was a hoax, and it's all manufactured and so on. And he's got a lot seemingly convincing evidence on that website. But of course, I'm thinking conspiracy theories abound, no matter what the subject. And I didn't give that much credence, but I did take to heart and try to find more evidence of statements attributed to Neil Armstrong. So that's why I raised the question tonight. Thanks very much for your insight. I'll be listening and standing by. K2RIW, this is W2MIT.
Yeah, one of the things that Neil Armstrong specifically said in a interview that he had something like 10 years ago was that to give him all the credit, just because he's the first person who put his foot on the moon, he thought was inappropriate, because I forget the exact number, maybe it was 400,000 people on planet Earth had something to do with creating the hardware, the orbital calculations and everything else. A large number of people were involved in this operation. And so if the Apollo moon landings, Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17, I think it's five missions, or was it six? Anyhow, you can count them. If that was really a hoax, if it was really a Hollywood production, my goodness, when you've got that many thousands of people involved in the mission, for all of them to keep that secret is out of the question. I, in particular, on Apollo 15 and 16, set up a 12-foot dish, aimed it at the moon, listened to the astronauts, listened to the command module, the lunar rover car, and the ALSA packages. I listened to those signals coming from the moon. And during the time they're coming back from the moon, when the aiming of my dish was just the right number of degrees away from the moon as they were coming back home, for somebody to put on a hoax by which a point in space emitted those 2287.5 megahertz signal with the command service module signal, for instance, to have a signal come from that point in space over that number of days, deviating by exactly those angles, having exactly those Doppler shifts, and coming out just right for my
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
For all of that to come out just right for my particular position in Farmingdale, the amount of effort they would have had to done during that hoax to convince me that it was real. Wow. And there's a hell of a lot of other people on other places in the earth using a Bauckham University, using one of the great big radio telescopes, was aiming their dish at just the right point, at just the right time, getting just the right signals. A number of people, seemingly very intelligent people, believe there was a hoax. Part of why they think there's a hoax is because the flag didn't wave the right way and the stars weren't obvious in the pictures. What you don't realize is that the soil on the moon is really half as black as coal, so to speak, but compared to the blackness of sky, it's a bright object. When the camera is properly adjusted to not be overexposed on the soil and the spacecraft and the white suit on the astronauts, with that kind of a camera setting, you're not going to be able to see stars. So each one of these things that they use as an example that it's a hoax, if you understand it correctly, it doesn't check out. Do you still think there's enough material there, Gary, to support a hoax? I think you've got to be very selective in the way you use the material.
That's actually incoming.
W2MIT, K2RIW, go ahead, Gary.
Hey, Wesley, recognized. Yeah, I think I've only heard the hoax argument with relation to the first mission, the very first mission, the 1969. It's awfully coincidental that the president at the time established a goal to reach the moon by the end of the decade. It was a serious, serious race with the Soviet Union to do so, and the fact that we made it just before the end of the decade, and also there had been estimates, as I recall, estimates of how long it would take us to develop the technology and to plan that mission, and I think they beat it by some factor of two or more to have brought it in to reality by 1969. So it's just the first one that I heard, the allegations that it was a hoax, and based on all these scientific estimates that were promulgated at the time. Go ahead, Dick, and you can turn over to Wesley.
W2CH also.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
CH and QIQ recognized. One of the things that you may not have experienced, Gary, is what I call wartime psychology, wartime philosophy. I've only experienced a little bit of it during Vietnam or Gulf War, where when people really dedicate themselves to what they think is an extremely serious goal, the war and the space program fall into those categories. People get an enthusiasm at a rate of progress. They can do miraculous things. They'll work 7 days a week and 12 hours a day. You'd be amazed what people can do when they are sufficiently driven. So the fact that a hell of a lot of breakthroughs took place in a small period of time doesn't surprise me. On top of that, when Kennedy made his pronouncement, at that time, the best thinking was you build a rocket big enough, you go straight from the Earth to the Moon, land on the, aim that rocket around backwards, land on the Moon, and then use the exact same rocket with the fuel that's left over and come back to Earth. At the time that Kennedy made that pronouncement, they thought that was going to be the scenario. Let me drop. And it turns out the Saturn V was something like 5.5 million pounds of thrust, and that particular vehicle was something like 365 feet tall when it blasted off. That particular vehicle would have been something like 4 or 5 times too small to do that mission. And can you imagine what it would be required to develop something multiple times bigger than the Saturn V? Not even Wernher von Braun could have done that in that time frame. If it wasn't for some particular very smart engineer at Grumman Aircraft who invented the concept of lunar orbit rendezvous, where only a small portion of the space vehicle goes down to the Moon and comes back, and the rest of it stays in orbit. It doesn't have to be deorbited and reorbited. A huge difference in energy requirements. That speeded up the process and drastically improved the amount of energy required to do that mission. So that was invented some number of years downrange of when Kennedy made his pronouncement. And again, it was wartime philosophy, wartime drive, if you would call it. There was a kind of a war. The so-called Cold War really was a war. If you worked in the military-industrial complex, if you worked on any kind of military hardware during that period of time, you would be amazed of the thinking then versus what we think now. My goodness. There were people worried that somebody was going to take over this whole nation by some kind of military takeover, and therefore you had to prepare the right kind of hardware to stop that from happening to defend yourself. In reality, it was crazy, but people believed that. And that arms race and the nuclear race and the space race are the results of some of the...
Repeater.
And the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, there's another one. That Manhattan Project made huge progress at a time where it was really needed. Tremendous resources were applied to that problem because we were scared to death that somebody else was going to develop one of those bombs before us and use it on us. W2CN, or CH, I think it was. What is your name, sir, and your comment? K2RIW, and my name is Dick.
KC2IS.
W2CH, good evening, Dick, K2RIW there. name is Ray in White Plains. We've spoken before, but I did have some interesting experiences back in ROTC in the 1960s when I was with the Air Force training. We visited Grumman in 1967 and went to see a mock-up or something. I remember going into the lunar module that they had there. And that was quite interesting. I don't remember the details of it being that long ago. Also, we were flying from Floyd Bennett Field once, I think it was January of 67, to Andrews Air Force Base on an ROTC trip, and our plane was delayed, the landing for the bodies of the three astronauts being brought from the Apollo 1 disaster. K2RAW W2CH.
Yeah, those were exciting times, Ray. Okay, we've got Glenn, Bill, and Wes in that order to make further comments. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go ahead.
Yeah, it's very interesting, you know, listening to a lot of comments, and I've read a lot of stuff about the, you know, the controversies with the, you know, with the space missions and where they, did they really land on the moon or not, and I personally am convinced that they did land on the moon, but there's more than enough evidence to show that they really did complete the missions. But I think, in hindsight, you know, comparing the moon missions to many other things that have, other events that have been documented very, very well, and happening so many years ago, that one would expect that there would be more information out there about the moon trips and you know, even personal accounts and biographies of the astronauts themselves about their experience visiting the moon. I'm just wondering, do you think that there's still things that are maybe top secret and, you know, kept from the public's eye from those original moon missions, Dick? I kind of get that impression that there should be a lot more available to the public this many years later after the successful moon missions that they had. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment on that also, Dick.
John, recognized. Each time I visited Edwards Air Force Base in California, and I went into the NASA bookstore, there's a section of the Edwards Air Force Base devoted to NASA. And as you know, the space shuttle quite frequently landed there. And I've experienced a space shuttle landing at Edwards. You go into that bookstore, Glenn, and you'd be amazed how many books written by the astronauts, how many books available on all of the NASA missions, the development of the hardware and whatever. You just haven't gone into the right bookstore. I think many of the astronauts wrote books of personal experience, and there's lots and lots of books available. I bought quite a few of them. There must be a section of my bookcase that is a foot and a half wide, just filled up with books that I bought at the NASA bookstore at Edwards Air Force Base. So you haven't been in the right place to find. There's a lot of information out there, Rick, Glenn. Bill was next. And
did I add something to that?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
I bet you I have probably as many books as you have and possibly more. I've made a very, very interesting collection of the Apollo missions. And not only published books, but many, many unpublished works as well. And put them together, trying to document as many possible things I could about the Apollo missions. And what's interesting was that there were, even in the past, there were items that used to be on the Internet. Some of them have disappeared. They're no longer there. And it's just kind of interesting that I know John said he had a comment about that. And something still, there, in my opinion, at least with all the information that I've had and read, there's some pretty big blanks I think are missing. Just an opinion, though. Maybe you could pass it over to John. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I don't think there's a lot missing. One of the things that we fail to realize is that NASA is a civilian organization, not military. When you watch that television program called I Dream of Jeannie, the so-called NASA people there wore a particular uniform, and you're led to believe it's a military organization. It was a civilian organization. I, for one, wrote letters to them asking for the frequencies, the methods of modulation, and whatever, of the command service module of Apollo. And I got that information mailed back to me. And they didn't think I could use it, and they were a little bit surprised that I managed to listen to the astronauts directly from Farmingdale with homebrew equipment, well, partially homebrew equipment, and a lot of borrowed equipment from the company I was working for at the time. So the only thing that was so-called classified is that some of the space shuttle missions did launch classified hardware. On those particular missions, when you used your NASA Select satellite television system, the audio was cut off at critical times. Sometimes the video was cut off at critical times when they were launching those pieces of hardware. So except for specific hardware that was transported into space by the shuttle, very little, as I see it, was classified, Glenn. Now, the next person was Bill, NC2IS. Go right ahead, Bill, with your comment. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. The call is AC2IS, Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra. But I was wondering if you had comment on the non-technical issue of the guy who came up with the lunar orbit rendezvous scheme, and how if this was not the favored solution within NASA, and even though that turned out to be the correct solution, how the gentleman's reputation and influence within NASA was damaged by him championing the correct solution.
I guess I don't know a great deal about that one, Bill. Whenever somebody comes through with what at first sounds like a radical idea, he's going to get flack. I mean, Copernicus got a lot of flack compared to the Ptolemaic system, if you know what I mean. Galileo got an awful lot of flack from the Catholic Church because he saw spots on the moon and it wasn't spots on the sun. And and he also saw craters on the moon. I mean, these supposedly perfect spatial objects with his telescope he was seeing, not only did they have blemishes, but they also were not going around the Earth, they were going around the Sun. He managed to get himself in an awful lot of trouble. So anybody with the right information at the wrong time is going to get flack. And so I don't know much about it, but you're telling me that he had trouble accepting the idea. However, I think they had no choice. Once they started doing back-of-the-envelope calculations, they rapidly realized that the best booster they had was way too small to do the mission if they didn't do lunar orbit rendezvous. So, yes, he may have gotten flack in the beginning, but he won in the end. And in the middle time, did he not get his proper promotions and whatever? That's kind of typical. That happens. I can give you some examples of that from my own life, but we won't go there right now. Wes was next on our list, and after that's going to be John. Into XJN. Wes, I know that some of your friends, one in particular, had a very strong opinion that the whole Apollo mission was a hoax. And when I gave that particular person specific information of what I experienced, he got awfully angry at me, because it was opposite of what he was positive was true.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
N2XJN, K2RIW, red was.
N2XJN. Well, basically, I believe that all of this conversation is a pure speculation. Whatever happened, we're not going to be able to prove it. We may say yes, we may say no. I believe it was a lot of evidence of the fact that this happened. What they might have do is use additional flavor. Let me jump. In other words, it was overdone in some areas just for the political reasons, and that's why we have the controversy. But because we have a technical net, and the time is running out. That is not going anywhere. It's nice to say the name of that person. I have a few questions important to me. One of them is variable permeability of the ferrite. What does that happen? And the other one is in the area of the video that I have sent to you, how the coil with the two shapes, two coils, but connected in series, how the properties or the eddy current works in the structure. The core is not closed. Andrew.
Understand. Okay, John was the next person on the list. KC2WGB, K2RW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, as well as you know and Glenn knows, you know, working with the government, they do clandestine things. No problem. I believe they do it. And they have to. But I support Glenn's position in this aspect. We have mapped the moon. Why haven't we located the Apollo 11 craft and the flag? It's there. Why don't they show it? Maybe they have, but I haven't heard it. That'll blow it away. There's Apollo 11 or whatever it was on the ground. There's the flag. There's the footprints. We have the resolution. We have the photography to do it. Why hasn't it been done?
Frank? The total number of satellites around the moon and their resolution of their optics is not quite as high as the total number of satellites around Mars and the resolution of that optics. The optics on Mars is able to find each one of the craft that are on the surface. One of the reports that I heard on the news this morning was that